Before we begin, has there been some discussion about the division of time for argument?
I think there's just two of us here.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought somebody else was sitting down. My apology. So, you may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Jason Scott, and I'm here today representing Christopher D., the father of Tyler. Christopher has appealed the portion of the separate juvenile court of Lancaster County's order which terminated his parental rights to his son. In short, I think this is simply a case where a father was never given a chance to be a parent to his son. And then when a decision was made to terminate the mother's parental rights in a separate case, he was brought along for the ride. I think when you look at the evidence presented in this case, you can draw a pretty fair inference that someone at the outset of this case decided that my client, Christopher, was not going to be permitted to be around his son. Steps were taken by the department to ensure that that didn't happen, and he was not given access to his son despite his best efforts to do so. And then they turn around and say, well, the reason we're terminating your rights is because you haven't been involved with your son. That just seems backwards to me. A couple of facts I think that are important in this case is that there was a separate case involving the mother. And this appeal doesn't come out of that case, but that began in September of 2009. My client attended those hearings. He was named in the petition as a party or as a father, but he was not an adjudicated party. From the outset of that case, he was asking for visits with his son. He met with the caseworker and said, I would like to have contact with my son. The response was, well, we need to have a paternity test done. Fair enough. So he tries to do that. He asks for help. The caseworker gives him a little bit of help, but she testifies that she's not really sure what she's doing, how to do this. Eventually, we get back into court in November and have the court order the department to provide a paternity test to happen. My guy does that in December. It takes until February for the son to provide his sample for the paternity test to be completed. And there wasn't ever really a good explanation why it took from the order in November until sometime in February for the son to have his part of the test done. In any event, the testing is done. My client is found to be the father. And so he contacts the department again and says, hey, we're done here. We got the test. Now can I have visits? And now they say, well, now we need a court order. Well, that was never an issue before. The court had never ordered that he could not have contact with his son. So there's back and forth on that. Eventually, we go into court. We get an order in June saying, the court says, yep, you got to give him visits. And that never happens. So, I mean, it just seems from the outset that the deck was stacked against Christopher here. He was never really given a chance. And then when you have the court turn around, the juvenile court, and find that there were sufficient grounds to terminate under 292 subsection 6, I just don't understand that.
Well, isn't part of the problem here that once, and granted, there may have been some delays that were unnecessary, and perhaps the department was at fault, but what isn't the real problem here that in June, when he's finally granted some visitation rights, then he becomes incarcerated?
It is true that he was incarcerated for a short period of time, but my response to that would be, you know, the court has consistently held that incarceration cannot be the grounds for termination of a parental rights here, and it was a short incarceration. But for the court to find under subsection 6 that he was given a reasonable opportunity to comply with a court-ordered plan, one, there wasn't a plan in his case. There was a plan in the other case that he was not an adjudicated party to. In that case, the plan for him was do genetic testing. He did it. We came back in, you know, do visits, but as part of getting visits, you have to cooperate with a psychological evaluation. He did that too. But they didn't give us the results of that evaluation until during the trial. And there were no efforts to make any of those recommendations, put them into place, give him an opportunity to comply with any of that. So I just don't think that there's any kind of sufficient evidence to support a finding under 292.6. There was no plan, there was no opportunity, and then if you look to see if the actions taken by the department were reasonable in this case, I find that hard to believe too. The other grounds that the court found for termination were under 292.2, substantially, continuously, repeatedly neglected his son. He wasn't given a chance. They said you can't have visits. He asked, will you do a home study? Will you come over and look at my place? Oh, well, we got to have paternity testing, and then that takes forever. And then you get done with that. Well, now we need an order. Well, and that takes forever. And then, you know, he was incarcerated for a short period of time. But if you hang your hat basically on that short incarceration, I don't think that squares with the law.
Well, but that at least explains at that point why he wasn't having visitation.
In June, yes. That doesn't explain. I don't think you can get to continuously and repeatedly starting in June. And I don't think that you can get to 292.6, reasonable opportunity to comply with the plan, if you start in June and blame him for that. And finally, as it relates to best interest, I don't really see much evidence as to that. I mean, this case was really, the evidence presented at trial was really about the mother. There was a therapist who testified who had met with the mother and seen the son and seen them together, those kinds of things. The therapist had never met my client. I don't think she knew anything about him except some things that were reported by the mother, which there was evidence that the mother was prone to exaggerate and maybe not always tell the truth. You know, I think all the evidence that was presented as it related to my guy that based the best efforts determination were just based on speculation and conjecture. I just don't see that there was a reasonable opportunity given to my client to participate in this case. And to turn around and terminate his parental rights based on the facts in this case, I don't think squares with the law. So we're asking this court to reverse the decision of the juvenile court, which terminated my client's parental rights to his son. Thank you.
What evidence at the hearing would have established that your client was in a position to care for his child?
Well, I think the evidence at the hearing was that he was going to be released from prison soon. I think it was either October or November. You know, it wasn't a situation where he was looking at a long extended incarceration. He was going to be out soon. If he would have ever been given an opportunity to participate in a plan, I mean, these juvenile court proceedings are designed to work toward reunification. You know, there's a two-way street, and there are a number of cases I'm sure you see where there's no going by the parents. It's all the department's trying, and nothing's happening. I think this case is different. I think that the father was actually making some effort here. I think the department was making probably less effort than they do in other cases. And I think to terminate on that is just not appropriate.
What about his history of mental health issues and the assault against the mother and some of his violent tendencies?
Well, a lot of that occurred well before Tyler was born. There was some that occurred after, but I think if you look at the evaluation from the, I can't remember if it was a psychologist or what his qualifications were, but the evaluation that was done of my client, it didn't say that he couldn't parent. It said that he needed maybe a little bit of, there were some skills that he could work on, but it didn't flat out say, you know, there are evaluations that come out that say, well, this doesn't have the capacity to parent. That's not what this one said. It said that there were some skills that could be developed. And I mean, it looked like there was some potential, things that could have been done, things that could have been worked on. I think, again, terminating based on that when he hasn't been given an opportunity is just premature.
What does the record reflect as far as the contact your client had with this child prior to the adjudication?
He had, the child was born, I believe in August or September of 2009, and he had contact with the child at the hospital. The child was in intensive care, so his contact was limited a little bit in that regard, but he did have contact until the department got involved, and then they basically threw up a roadblock and said, well, you got to do paternity testing, and then went from there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Shelley Sabata and I'm a deputy county attorney from the Lancaster County Attorney's Office and we represent the appellee in this matter. We are asking that the court affirm the termination of parental rights that was ordered in the Lancaster County, separate juvenile court of Lancaster County, I think we need to look at this much more broadly than what appellant is attempting to do in looking at a very narrow set of facts at the very end of the situation. The case law is very clear that it's appropriate to look at Mr. Davis's entire lifestyle when we're looking at whether or not he's neglected this child. When we're looking at, I'd like to focus on the 43-292 subsection 2, the substantially and continuously or repeatedly neglected this child. And the case law is very clear in saying that a parent's failure to put themselves in a position to parent or to provide an environment that's safe and stable for a child are all things we can look at, as well as their entire lifestyle.
Well, what about the argument that this father did make efforts? He inquired about setting up visitation, and then the genetic testing took a while, and getting a court order took a while, but in the meantime, he's making efforts to try to establish a relationship.
There were some delays in the case, and there were some reasons for that, but I don't think that he was making efforts. I don't think some token efforts of every once in a while saying, I'd like to have a visit, what do I do? This child was born in July of 2009. The evidence at the trial was that the child was in the NICU for 3 months. There were absolutely no restrictions on his visitation by the department or anyone else other than standard hospital rules for his visits. He himself chose to exercise visitation 5 times before anyone got involved, and it was in the first few weeks of the child's life. He stopped completely on his own at that point. The testimony was no one restricted any contact at the hospital. So the first 3 months of the child's life, he saw the child a total of a couple of hours through his own doing. So then for him to then, and then the motion for visitation that he filed, the case started in August of 2009, wasn't filed till June of 2010. So him taking any active efforts, even though he had counsel from the beginning, to request court's assistance in getting visitation arranged, took almost a year on his part as well. And then I think with his efforts as well, you know, the case law is clear.
Excuse me, but sure. Wasn't part of that problem because the department was kind of stonewalling the situation? I mean, they didn't indicate they knew what he needed to do to get the paternity testing done. They didn't get the blood from the child. I mean, to go from November to February before the blood is drawn from the child so that they can determine the paternity, you can't put that on him.
The delay in having the child's draw or swab done was, you know, the child's in the department's custody. That was their responsibility to do. I can't necessarily speak for what was going on other than the worker testified that she was unfamiliar with the practices in our county. She was a worker assigned due to a conflict in another county, and there were just delays on that occurring. I guess what I'd also like to focus on, though, is Mr. Davis's actions throughout the pendency of Tyler's life and this court case. That I think makes this very different than a very recent case that this court just issued an opinion on, the Leland B case, somewhat similar in that the parent was incarcerated and it was a termination of parental rights. But I think what's very different in that case is, first of all, that father was incarcerated prior to the juvenile court case commencing, which was different here. Mr. Davis, knowing full well that Tyler was his child, engaged in the continuous assaults of the mother, the violations of the protection orders that led to his incarceration at the time of the trial. And in Leland B., also, the father at that point had a long-term relationship with the child. He was a primary caregiver before the court case commenced. He maintained contact with Health and Human Services. The evidence established Mr. Davis did not do that. He maintained contact with the child through writing letters. Mr. Davis made no effort to do anything in that regard as well. And that parent also, there was evidence that he participated in programming while incarcerated, parenting education, substance abuse treatment that Mr. Davis never did. And those were issues for him that were very important. So when we look at Mr. Davis's entire lifestyle and the decisions he was making, he was in no position, not just for incarcerated reasons or for the reasons for the incarceration, but his life in general. He does have a very long history of severe mental health diagnoses and hospitalizations. There was Dr. Stankus's psychological evaluation that listed some pretty serious diagnoses that would need to be addressed.
But didn't the evaluation also say, you know, if there's evaluations and if there's, you know, ongoing treatment and therapy and so forth, that he could possibly place himself in a position to parent?
Correct.
And how does that factor into the plan or lack of plan by the department in this case?
Well, Part of it is that this was an adjudication hearing on an original neglect petition simultaneous with the termination, so it wasn't the standard timeline of having had a previously ordered plan specifically addressing Dr. Stankus's recommendations. His evaluation, I think, occurred about a month before the termination proceedings. I guess how I would respond to that is to say that the list of things that Dr. Stankus said that Mr. Davis would need to do is extremely long. There were some pretty involved things that Mr. Davis would need to do and maintain. And there was no evidence that he had started any of that or was in a position to even start that when he was incarcerated. One of the main things he would have to have done was to get out of jail, and he was serving a maximum sentence for the current situation involving the assault and the protection order violation on the mother, which was 180 days. He would need to get out. He would need to remain in the community and stay out of jail, which is something Mr. Davis, in the record, was not able to do. He testified having been incarcerated more than 10 times. He would need to establish some sort of a safe and stable residence, some sort of financial support, stability, all of those things. It was just a lot of things that needed to be done, as well as substance abuse, given that Mr. Davis, in the evaluation, indicated substance abuse beginning at the age of 8 years old. Then there was also the mental health component that would need to be addressed as well. So there were a lot of things that need to be done, and I think this then becomes sort of a poster child case for how long does Tyler need to wait in foster care. He went straight from the NICU in the hospital to foster care. He was almost 2 years old at the time of the trial. Almost 2 years old now. He was 14 months at the time of the trial. He's in a home that's willing and able to provide permanency. He's bonded there versus Mr. Davis, that he has had absolutely no relationship other than the couple of hours Mr. Davis chose to spend with him at the NICU. And so we would be asking Tyler to wait, you know, an indefinite period of time to see if Mr. Davis can follow through with all of these things, when what we've seen of his history, as well as prior to and during this case, during Tyler's life, establishes that he doesn't have that stability or consistency. I know that there were some of the issues regarding the genetic testing, but Mr. Davis indicated too that, you know, from the very beginning he was very certain that the child was his. He was there when the child was born. He held himself out to be Tyler's father. And so knowing that himself, and him saying that there was no possibility he was not the father, which were statements that he made, then he should have been putting himself in a position to be able to parent this child, and he just wasn't. He was continuing to engage in criminal behavior that took him out of the community. One of the things that would have likely been part of a rehabilitative plan would have been some domestic violence training or education. And he testified that part of why he was incarcerated when he was having violated some of the terms that were already put on him previously through those cases, specifically having not finished domestic violence education. So he did have some, you know, options through the criminal cases to do that, and he didn't take part in those or complete those. So I think that's one of the main reasons that the case should be affirmed, and that is that Tyler is in need of permanency. And that's something that could be afforded immediately, as opposed to the uncertainty of Mr. Davis's situation and whether he will make those changes, which are things that, you know, have been lifelong issues for him, and whether he will commit to do that on behalf of his son when there was just no evidence provided that he's been willing to do that thus far, in addition to the incarceration and the flat-out unavailability.
I understand the record correctly, that he could not have visitation until the paternity testing was completed?
That is generally, I believe that is what the record indicates, and that's the general position of Health and Human Services in these situations, is to have a parent basically establish standing, you know, to be able to participate as a parent in a case.
So there's about a four-month delay in getting a blood draw or a swab from the child?
Yes, from November to February.
Okay. So do we hold that against him?
No, he didn't have control over Health and Human Services presenting the child for the swab.
Okay.
I would agree with that.
So after the child is tested, how much time elapses between that and when he goes
into
jail?
The testing occurred in February. I don't know when the results came out. At that point, then the department did indicate that they I can't speak for kind of what the representative was thinking, but it appeared that they wanted to defer that to the court and have an opportunity. You know, we objected to the visitation, so to put on evidence and have a hearing on visitation, so they referred him to his attorney to file a motion, which then was filed not until much later in June of 2010. The record also established that Mr. Davis didn't even appear at that motion hearing, but the visitation was granted over our objection.
Thank
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
How much time does appellant have remaining?
Thank you. Just a couple things in rebuttal. As Judge Seegers pointed out, you know, we don't want kids to be in foster care forever, but at the same time, you know, you can't hold that stuff against my guy. You know, they told him you got to do paternity testing. It didn't get done until February. That wasn't his fault. Then they turn around and say, well, now you got to file a motion. Well, I'm sure you all know that, you know, by the time you file a motion, that you don't get a hearing the same day. It takes a little while for you to actually get on the court's calendar. So the hearing was in June. The motion was filed previously to that.
He incarcerated at the time of the hearing?
No, he was not.
But he wasn't there?
He was not there. You know, what we have here is a situation where the department was kind of presenting a moving target. Well, first you got to do paternity testing. Well, now you need a motion. Now you need an order. And we have a guy who has some mental health issues. I think that plays into it a little bit, and I think the department has to be held to at least the standard of doing what they would do for everybody else. Maybe they should do, I think you could argue that maybe they should try a little harder when someone has mental health issues, but they got to at least try as hard as they would with anybody else, and I don't think they did. I think the evidence is pretty clear that they just didn't do everything for this guy that they could have. And to terminate because of that is just not appropriate.
Thank you, counsel. You are both excused and the case is submitted. Next case is Rogers versus Rogers.